Hello and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, managing editor of Town Hall, and today I am joined by...
I'm Robert Verbruggen, the editor of RealClearPolicy.com.
Great, thanks for being on with me today, Robert. I wanted to kind of chat about with Robert is the general, and this is kind of a debate that's popped up recently, conservative policies towards tackling poverty. And since we're, 50 years out from LBJ's famous declaration of a war on poverty and the institution of a lot of federal anti-poverty programs, there's been a little intra-conservative debate on tackling poverty and a critique of conservatism in general for its anti-poverty proposals being maybe insufficient to tackle poverty. So first off, I wanted to ask you, Robert, do you think that A, the conservative movement does have a coherent and workable anti-poverty program, and B, are progressives' critiques of conservatives off base here?
Well, I certainly do think that there's a reasonable conservative critique of the current welfare state, and I think that that critique goes all the way back to Charles Murray's Losing Ground. I think what conservatives are always focused on when it comes to poverty is the incentives that we're creating, and I think they have a lot of very good points about that, and I think they have a lot of good ideas in terms of how to reform the programs that we have so that they encourage better behavior and encourage people to actually become self-sufficient as opposed to just relieving poverty for the sake of relieving poverty in the near term. That said, there are certainly reasonable critiques of the conservative movement. I think it's probably true that conservatives have spent less time on poverty than maybe they should have. I think it's true that for a lot of conservatives, it's sort of toward the bottom of the list in terms of what policies they're really excited about. You always hear conservatives talking about tax cuts, a lot more than you ever hear them talking about poverty. So I do think there are reasonable critiques of what the conservatives are doing, but I also think that there are very real ideas here that I think people need to consider seriously.
What is actually interesting to me is the revival of a respectability, I guess, for the general kind of conservative preference for doing a lot of policy through the tax code. So, for example, the earned income tax credit is very popular on the left and mildly popular on the right as basically a welfare program through the tax code, saying that we are able to provide cash incentives towards people at the bottom of the income ladder via the tax code, which to me is kind of a way that conservatives have been able to fuse their penchant for tax cuts, let's say, with assistance in the form of welfare benefits for people towards the bottom of the income ladder. So kind of the traditional conservative approach to a lot of things, like you said, is just advocate for tax cuts. And it depends on if you want to call something like the EITC a tax cut. But it does seem like there might be room there for conservatives to actually cohesively align around, these anti-poverty programs that are done through the tax code.
That's a really interesting point, and I think there are very conservative arguments you can make about basically looking at this as a marginal tax rate. One of the biggest problems with a lot of the poverty programs is that as you earn more money, you lose your benefits. So at some areas of the income scale, very low-income people can face a marginal tax rate of up to 95%. According to the Congressional Budget Office report on that. It's a little bit difficult to make the case, though, because what you're talking about are actually benefits provided to people. Like the earned income tax credit is done through the tax code, but it's a refundable credit, so people are actually getting back more than they're paying in. So I think conservatives definitely will listen to an argument about marginal tax rates, and they'll definitely be amenable to those sorts of ideas. But the very core, I think, of the conservative hatred of taxes is that you're taking money from people and giving it to other people, or you know, spending it on the government's priorities. And I think that, you know, that's just sort of true with the earned income tax credit. You're taking money that's collected elsewhere, you know, from other people, and sending it to people as a tax rebate when in fact they haven't paid that much in taxes to begin with.
Right. Income cliffs is a really interesting critique, and I think that conservatives are generally on base with that. Because there are fairly large welfare cliff disincentives as you climb out of poverty. And there are two general approaches to that. One is to say you need to make the cliff far less of a, more of a general gradual slope as you climb out of poverty. And then, like, you know, have full phase out of welfare benefits at higher income levels. I don't see that solution as gaining a lot of traction on the right, because you don't want to say, you know, these people at $60,000-$70,000, which and this is a criticism that came into play with Obamacare, you don't want to see people at $60,000 or $70,000 of, you know, earned income a year still receiving welfare benefits from the government, because, you know, those people are fairly comfortably above the median family income in the United States, and they're still receiving government benefits. So at what point do you say, you know, this much redistribution above the income ladder is enough? The other would be to make a more of a sloping, you know, welfare cliff at lower levels of the income ladder, so that, you know, there might be disincentives for climbing out of poverty, but it's, you know, you're still not at a comfortable level, and obviously you would want incentives to work and, you know, better your situation in life to still be in effect at the point that welfare benefits kind of phase out. But that, and this is the flip side of that, that sometimes seems a little cruel, because at, you know, very saying, you know, you're phasing out welfare benefits at very low income levels, you know, sub $30,000 a year levels. And I think that 95% cliff is around between $30,000 and $35,000. I don't remember exactly where it is, but it is fairly significant at that level. So you have to kind of balance where you're going to phase out the welfare state with trying to continue to incentivize people to work, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I think a big part of it is just sort of, and this is one of the elements of Marco Rubio's poverty plan, is to sort of bring all these different programs together. We have something like 80 different poverty programs, and they're all sort of phasing out at different levels to different degrees. And that's what a big part of what creates a lot of these cliffs, because you have, you know, different people setting, you know, different cliffs that happen to end up around the same place. So I think if you bring it all together and say, you know, what do we want this overall curve to look like? You know, at what point do we want to phase it out? I think you could do it a lot more intentionally than what we have now. I don't think anybody sat there and said, you know, I want a 95% cliff at such a low income level. I think it's just something that happened as people were putting together various programs.
Right. We can look at it. We can certainly look at it as kind of a, I mean, we have a very messy welfare state right now, and we can look at it as kind of a historical accident that we got to this point. And to that extent, these comprehensive, I would say, welfare state replacement programs like Marco Rubio's have a lot of upside to them. But I think that this is a fairly important distinction between, when we're talking about proposals like this, a distinction between left and right. And generally, conservatives see welfare state reform as something that's going to replace the existing status quo welfare state, whereas a lot of progressives see reforms like basic income guarantees, cash assistance, things like that, as going on top of the existing welfare state. And this is a, it sounds like it's not that big of a difference, but it's a fairly huge difference, because the current welfare state, we say there are certain goods and services that the government, both state and federal governments, are going to supply to people at the bottom of the income ladder that are things that we say they need. So we have food stamps, we have Medicaid, because people need food and health care. But a lot of, I think, conservative replacement programs would say, all right, we're going to take the sum total of the, you know, price of everything that you're getting, and we're going to give it to you in the form of cash. Now, if you don't buy food and healthcare, that's on you. Whereas progressives say, no, we're still going to provide them with food and healthcare and also some cash, so that, you know, that's where their choices come in. But we're still going to say you have to have food and healthcare from the government.
Right. I mean, it really has to do with the overall level of benefits that we're providing. I mean, liberals are very much, I think, content in a way to relieve poverty just by giving people money. And I think conservatives realize that, you know, there's going to be some of that, you know, that, you know, if somebody is poor, you know, at least on a temporary basis, you know, we need to help them out a bit. But conservatives really are looking at, you know, incentives here and how can we get people to sort of raise themselves up and give them incentives to raise themselves up. And that's just not something you can do when you provide, you know, the high level of benefits that the liberals would like to provide. I think it's, you know, two very different ways of looking at the problem and two very different ways of looking at what we're trying to accomplish here.
Right, yeah, and so something I think getting into Marco Rubio's proposal, which is, I believe, and I haven't delved into, you know, the whole details of it, but I believe would be a kind of welfare state replacement program, right? Do you find that, and this is, I mean, side note here, but Marco Rubio has been fairly active in the policy sphere if you take into account his support for comprehensive immigration reform and this new anti-poverty set of proposals that he's proposing. But do you think that this is what he's proposed and kind of what he's trying to coalesce around is something that the conservative movement is going to find a, you know, good reception in the conservative movement and something that would be a viable and popular reform for the conservative movement to coalesce around when it comes to poverty?
That you talked about earlier about doing things through the tax code, but you would basically be giving people a steady stream of income instead of this big lump sum sort of tax credit. I think that's a really great idea. I think it's going to help people who are poor, you know, budget more rather than giving them, you know, basically a, you know, a thank you for working check at the end of the year. So I think that's actually a very good reform, and a lot of liberals are very, as you said, they would prefer to keep the earned income tax credit and do the wage subsidy too. But a lot of them have, you know, written very positive things about it, and they're very amenable to that. The other plank of his platform is going to be a lot more controversial, though, which is to basically block grant a lot of the welfare spending to the states. And the question here is, you know, what do you think of the states? Is it a lot of liberals are saying it's just going to be a red and blue issue. You know, the red states aren't going to put up a very good safety net. We're just going to have a lot of poverty in red states because, you know, these evil conservatives aren't going to want to do anything about it. By contrast, you know, Rubio himself and somebody who's more favorable to conservative ideas is going to say, you know, we should allow the states to just experiment with this, do the best that they can, fail a bit, you know, find out what works, what doesn't work, and that way we can move ahead and actually try to move people past poverty instead of just sending them checks so that they can, you know, feed themselves and get medical care.
Right, and what's actually, it was reported that obviously we've seen a lot of criticisms from the left on this, but there were some conservative scholars who didn't like the kind of federalism aspect of Marco Rubio's proposal either. I think it was Robert Rector at the Heritage Foundation critiqued it on the basis kind of that some of the more liberal states, you know, your New Yorks, your Vermonts, your Massachusetts, are going to use those, I don't think he calls them block grants, but they're basically block grants, to put into place policies that conservatives would be dead set against, you know, spending federal money on. And obviously the progressive critique is that red states, their welfare net might have a lot of holes in it and they would be less comprehensive. And you see that with kind of the Medicaid program, where red states, let's say, have much lower spending on Medicaid and kind of more stringent requirements and lower coverage as opposed to the blue states. And that would probably be a feature of Marco, if this were implemented, that would probably be consistent with Marco Rubio's program as well, where we see a lot of different experimentations. But, I mean, I'm a conservative. I don't see the, I mean, I see the upside of that a lot, is which is that we would get a lot of experimentation in the States, maybe some new innovative ways of tackling poverty that we're just not going to see at the federal level, and we're not going to see when the rules for dollars are made by people in Washington, D.C., rather than by people in Chicago or Texas or Florida or things like that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it really does depend on what you think of the states. My understanding of the details aren't completely clear yet, but my understanding is that there's going to be, you know, some sort of formula where we look at, you know, what states are getting now, and we try to give them, you know, sort of that sort of amount of money for starters, and then we make some adjustments as it goes on. But I mean, I think, you know, from a Federalist perspective, you know, if you're a conservative who doesn't like how Vermont deals with poverty, don't live in Vermont. As long as it's not a system like, you know, the current Medicaid system where Vermont can spend more money and that means they get more money from the federal government. If they're getting a set amount of money and deciding what to do with it, I mean, I guess I don't see the problem with that from a conservative perspective, because even if you don't agree with what another state is doing, I think from a Federalist perspective, you're supposed to allow them to, you know, sort of do what they're doing and experiment and find out what works for them.
Right. And you see this, I mean, within the conservative movement, at least anecdotally, conservatives don't seem to have a problem with that in general. You see, you know, you go up to people at someone at a Tea Party rally or something like that, and you ask them about California, and they say, well, it's California's choice to run themselves into the ground, with, you know, a lot of the state policies that they have that conservatives disagree with. And that's kind of surprising when you say, you know, California is the largest state-based economy in the United States, and California running itself into the ground is going to have negative effects for everybody else. But they still say, you know, it's their, their state. They run it how they want to run it. I'm not going to go there, and they can run themselves into the ground. And I think that you would see that generally among conservatives, which was why it was surprising, I think, to see even one, you know, conservative policy analyst critique this from that point of view, saying that we're going to get some outcomes in a bunch of different states that we would disagree with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, in his defense, though, I think he's absolutely right that I think a lot of the liberal approaches to poverty, you know, from a conservative perspective, have been pretty disastrous. I mean, if you look at, you know, again, I'm going all the way back to Losing Ground, this idea that having, you know, too generous of a safety net that cuts off when people, you know, start earning their own money creates really powerful bad incentives. And I think it's reasonable to be concerned about what's going to happen in, you know, states that, you know, do things that you might not agree with. But at the same time, I think it's just so much better to let states experiment, let states do what works for them, and let states do things that reflect the values of the people who live there.
Right. Now, I want to get back to something you said earlier, basically the idea that conservative anti-poverty proposals are trying to help people basically dig themselves out of poverty, right? Is that it's based around work incentives, it's based around wage subsidies, things like that. The progressive critique, I think, is largely that people who are born into poverty, and let's say adults who are in poverty, is largely a circumstance of bad luck, not that people are lazy or people don't want to work or people want to stay in poverty. And because of that, conservative approaches to anti-poverty programs are based kind of in the idea that it's about incentivizing people to be better people themselves. And the progressives say, you know, that's not the case. These people are there not by choice, by luck, and that it's really basically heartless to take that approach, that incentivizing work is the right way to go. So I wanted to get kind of your perspective on that, and if that is a salient critique of the conservative approach to poverty.
I mean, I certainly wouldn't ever want to blame somebody for being in poverty. I mean, poverty is a really rough thing. Nobody likes it. But I think it always goes back to the sort of the classic formulation from, you know, the Clinton era, that, you know, if you work full time, if you graduate high school, and if you get married before you have children, the odds of being in poverty are very low. Also, if you look at sort of the statistics on household income, you'll see that the people at the lowest end of the spectrum have very few earners in the house, where the people at the highest end of the spectrum always have, you know, two earners in the house. It really is about work, and it really is about getting people to get into jobs. And there are obviously obstacles for that, obstacles to that for various people. But I think the idea that we can change behavior and, you know, make sure that the economy has jobs for everyone and, you know, eradicate poverty that way, I mean, certainly seems to jive with the numbers that you see if you look at just the distribution of poor households. I mean, unmarried childbearing is another, you know, obviously big obstacle, something that, you know, really keeps people in poverty. So I think any reasonable person has to agree that behavior is a big part of the poverty problem.
It's an interesting, I think, thing. So I would say, at least people on the libertarian end of the conservative spectrum would say that using government using government policy to teach behavior. And the libertarian wing would say that's A, impossible, and B, not something that the federal government should be doing. So that seems to come into maybe a bit of a clash within, I would say, the broader right side of the spectrum, that I not that I don't think that that is correct, but it seems like that would make it harder to kind of coalesce a movement around government policy that, as you said, teaches behavior.
I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. I think most people agree that we need some sort of safety net, but most people also agree that we shouldn't be providing benefits to people for not working, that we shouldn't be, you know, basically providing people extra money when they have children that they can't afford. I think that people agree in general, if we shouldn't be actively shaping behavior, we at least shouldn't be rewarding bad behavior. And I think that the current welfare state does that to a large degree.
Okay, that if you make the distinction between, between incentivizing good behavior or incentivizing bad behavior, or just not... or disincentivizing good behavior versus incentivizing bad behavior, that's probably more accurate. And not to say that, I would say that a lot of libertarians would actually be behind a lot of these programs. They just wouldn't frame it as teaching behavior from via federal policy. But on that note, I wanted to get your thoughts on, you mentioned kind of encouraging marriage and encouraging household creation and encouraging dual income households. Do you see, so there's been a little bit of a debate on if it's a chicken and egg problem of, does marriage create, is marriage in and of itself an anti-poverty program, or is it just that the type of people who are taught or believe that getting married before actually having kids or starting a family is more important, what kind of does create that anti-poverty behavior? Is it the actual act of getting married, or is it that people who are apt to get married already know the kind of the right behaviors to get out of poverty and to actually create stable households?
I mean, I certainly think it's a little bit of both. A lot of these sort of middle class values tend to all go together. So if you have one, you tend to have the others. But I think it's basically undeniable that if you wait to get married before you have kids, at least, that's not to say that you have to get married, period, but if you, at least if you choose to have kids, get married first, I think it's basically undeniable that that's just a better situation for people. It is very difficult to raise a child by yourself, and doing that by choice is just basically a decision that really contributes to poverty. So I think the sort of the broader debate, sort of focuses on, at the lower income edge of the spectrum, people are, if you find someone to get married to, it's probably going to be another low income person, and those households can be unstable in a variety of ways. But, when kids are in the picture, I think it's pretty clear that, getting married is a good idea. And I think that's it. When children are involved is, I think, where we should really be focusing our efforts.
Okay. But, The question I think would obviously focus on the margins here, right, is that someone who is dead set against getting married early to someone they have a child with who they don't want to, their, like, government incentives for marriage aren't going to work for that person. So the question is, do they actually work on the margins as well, where you're going to be, like, government policy is going to be able to encourage a couple thousand people a year to start a household rather than go their separate ways. And I haven't seen the data on that, and I'm curious if you think that there are actually people who are going to respond to government incentives there.
I think the incentive versus disincentive distinction comes into play here too, because, you know, again, at the lower end of the spectrum, if you get married, a lot of times you'll lose benefits if you bring another income into the household. So I think, you know, sort of restructuring those programs, or we're at the very least not punishing people for getting married, just seems like a no-brainer thing to do. I don't think you should be you should lose money when you get married. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right, though, that when it comes to government policy versus personal decision making, you know, we can take the, you know, the full Charles Murray line and say, you know, cut the Gordian knot, just eliminate all, you know, sort of welfare and just leave it to that. And then people will realize that, you know, they can't support the kids and they won't have them. But I mean, that's just not a viable option. It's not going to happen politically. And it would be really horrible for the kids who are already trapped in those kind of situations to do that. So I do think you're right that we're talking about a very small margin here where we can actually make a difference.
Right. And it might be more of a cultural kind of influence here rather than a government influence saying that, you know, if you want to have kids, you need to have a stable household before you make that decision. And I mean, government policy does play into culture. I'm not someone who thinks it doesn't. But it does seem like there is maybe a limited sphere for government in that decision, right?
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there's a lot of actually sociological research on this. There was a book called Promises I Can Keep out about 5 years ago or so. And you're absolutely right. Basically, there are, you know, these women sort of get the idea that they, you know, they really want to have children, but they feel like they don't have you know, they don't have men in their lives that they could see themselves marrying, so that they basically decide to put childbearing first. And, you know, where the government enters into that, you know, it's really hard to say.
Right. Now, it seems like what I've seen, when we start talking on the right about how government needs to create an environment, like you said, where we're not penalizing marriage, where we're trying to get people to have nuclear families, we want... and that is going to, you know, create better outcomes down the line. The progressive response is to say, well, one of the best ways to give people options there is abortion, basically. Saying that if, you know, you are at a place where a child is maybe an option, abortion is a really good kind of policy response to that, saying that people don't have to have children before they get married. We want to give them these options. And I kind of wanted to get your take on how the pro-choice movement, let's say, plays into this.
Well, I mean, I think there are two important things to bear in mind there. One is that most of the, you know, as I discussed about, you know, the sociological research about unwed childbearing, a lot of it isn't accidental pregnancies. It's women who, you know, decide that they want to have a child. And we have, abortion is legal in all 50 states now, and we still have this massive problem with it. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, pretty clear that people are choosing to do this already. But the second thing is that, you know, I always find it kind of pointless to debate abortion almost, because it really just goes down to the question of whether you think, you know, the child is a human life at various stages of fetal development. So the trade-off to somebody who's pro-choice is, you know, well, we don't really have anything that we're worried about here. This is just a choice we can give people. It's not a big deal. Whereas if you're a pro-lifer, you think, well, this is a human life. No, you can't take a human life for the purpose of, you know, encouraging, you know, more nuclear families. That's not right. So it really goes to the deeper issue there as well.
Right. And that's not something that is ever, it might get solved eventually, but it's not going to get solved from empirical argument. Right. And so I think that's an interesting, I think, counter that, yes, abortion is legal in all 50 states, and we still are seeing this degradation of two-parent families. In fact, possibly with the rise of abortion, we've seen the degradation of two-parent families, right? That we now have more single parents, more single mothers, more single fathers, even in the presence of a legalized abortion regime.
Right. I mean, I've seen various arguments about that. One is that it was just sort of a broader culture of sexual license. Another is that it sort of created this competition where, you know, even women who weren't willing to have abortions were, you know, sort of pressured into, you know, having sex earlier, you know, so that they could, you know, compete with other women who were willing to have abortions. I mean, there are all sorts of arguments about that, but it's certainly clear that as abortion rose, unwed childbearing rose as well. So it certainly doesn't seem to be an all-purpose solution. It, at best, it affected things along the margins.
Right. Although we've been talking about policy that maybe just affects on the margins, and the margins are sometimes important. Sorry, what?
No, you're right. I mean, it just, again, goes back to the issue of what we're talking about when we're talking about abortion, if we're talking about the taking of a human life or if we're just talking about a choice we can give to people.
Right. So I guess, kind of to sum up here, we see Marco Rubio has come out with kind of this unified proposal, but we've seen conservatives and prominent conservative movement figures in the past come out with anti-poverty programs or even generally policy proposals that address places that the conservative movement has maybe underserved for a long time, and they just don't get any traction. Do you see a future for a conservative anti-poverty policy regime?
I think it really is just going to depend on elections. I mean, I think if we have, you know, another election in, you know, the next few years here, if we put a different president in, if we take control of, you know, the Republicans take control of both sides of Congress, I mean, then, you know, Republicans can do whatever they want. Whereas, you know, now trying to put something through when the conservative movement itself is kind of divided about these sorts of things, and then you have, you know, Democrats in control of a lot of stuff, I mean, I think that's going to be really hard. So I think it's going to depend on whether Republicans win. I mean, that's really going to be the question as to whether they can actually get something through and whether they can coalesce around something. Because right now, even if the Republicans completely agreed on a certain set of policy proposals, I'm not sure it would make a difference.
That's true, that basically when you're out of power, nobody coalesces around anything, because coalescing around something carries a political price. But the cynic would say that these are, and let's say GOP healthcare proposals are along the same lines, but that these are things that Republicans are for when they're out of power, and once they get back into power, they are just going to propose tax cuts again, or let's say income tax cuts for the wealthy again, and that's kind of the cycle of Republicanism. Do you see, even in power, Republicans and conservatives addressing these low-served areas of policy that we haven't seen in the past?
Well, I'm certainly no great fan of the Republican Party. I'm not going to, you know, offer something really optimistic here, but I mean, Republicans have tackled poverty before. You know, they even then, when Clinton was in power, they worked with him. A lot of people in his administration were really angry about that. You know, so that they have gotten things done on poverty in the past, and the, you know, the current reforms in some ways echo the 1996 welfare reform. So, I mean, I don't think we can write it off. I think it's very possible that they'll, you know, try to do something real here.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining me today, Robert. And hopefully, I would hope that conservatives do continue to serve these underserved policy areas. But thanks a lot again for joining me, and hopefully I will see everyone another time on another Blogging Heads.
Thank you.